Bhadram karne bhi shrunuyama devaha Bhadram hashe maksha bhirya jatraha Stirayarangai istustu vagam sastanubhihi Vyashe madevahi tanyadayuhu Om shanti shanti shantihi. May we hear with our ears what is auspicious. May we see with our eyes what is auspicious. May we enjoy with strong limbs and body the life allotted to us. Om, peace, peace, peace. Our subject this morning is worship the living God. The idea of service in Vedanta is not a new one, and it can be traced to some of our ancient scriptures, such as the Rig Veda and the Yajurveda. And later we can find references in the Puranas, especially the Bhagavad Gita. As many of you know, the Bhagavad Gita is actually the manual for doing work as a spiritual service. But Swami Vivekananda's slant of service to humanity with a spiritual motive is in a way an original contribution. He has actually given us a new paradigm. He not only reinterpreted the old teachings to suit the times, but in addition, he creatively presented the idea of looking upon humankind as divine and serving everyone as worship, as a means for individual growth and for the benefit of others. You know, the truths, the ancient truths of Vedanta, they have to be made practical. They have to fit into our everyday life and our circumstances in order to be fruitful for us as spiritual seekers. We have to adapt to the times, and this is what Swami Vivekananda has done for us. You know, if God alone exists, and everything in the universe is a manifestation of God, all the beings within the universe, then whomsoever we meet or come into contact with is actually a manifestation of God himself or herself. And furthermore, whatever work we are doing, if we do it with this attitude, it becomes a worship of God. Now, in restating the ancient ideas, Swamiji needed to prepare the ground. In the Indian religious tradition, even as late as the 19th century, there were some pretty preconceived ideas about how a religious or a spiritual person should live, especially for monastics, but just people in general. They should remain aloof from society and the affairs of the world. And furthermore, there was like a stereotypic austere way of life that was associated with being spiritual that did not quite fit in to what we would think of as a normal course of life. So generally, contact with people or the affairs of the world, it didn't fit into this and was definitely considered to be an obstacle to spiritual growth. And this can be found, these ideas can be found in Shankara's and other orthodox Vedantic teachings. But I feel that as much as we admire our ancient acharyas, Shankaracharya lived in the 8th century. This is the 21st century. Times have changed. And all of these great acharyas that are associated with Vedanta or any major religion, they are embodiments of the divine to suit the needs of the time. And as time passes, the needs also change. So Swamiji actually came to shift this emphasis. Shankara's emphasis, Swamiji had great admiration for Shankara's intellect, his teachings, etc. But Swamiji came to shift the emphasis on how people can actually take these teachings and make them a reality in their day-to-day life. You know, Swami Vivekananda always emphasized the positive aspect of searching for truth. You can't find anything negative in the teachings of Swami Vivekananda. He didn't feel it was necessary to reject anything. Swamiji accepted everything. So he developed a more contemporary way of looking at work and people based on Sri Ramakrishna and his own experience of the unity of existence, of the one being, the one divine being that dwells within everyone. The ideal of service is based upon this transcendent experience of unity and diversity. Service of humanity as worship is really only an application of this experience of oneness. Swamiji not only had a new view, but he proposed a unique way of applying this in everyday life for all of us, which was the worship of God and people, a relevant message for our times. And before we proceed, I would think we should expand what we normally consider as worship. We need to extend the meaning of worship. You know, normally we think of worship in all religions as some sort of an official, it's an adoration for the divine, for a deity, a saint, or a holy person. It's usually within certain parameters, and we offer flowers, or we offer light, we offer incense. All of these are very valid and wonderful practices. This is one form of worship. And Swamiji's definition of the worship of the divine in man as a spiritual practice is a different type of worship, which we will see as we go along. One of the main things that Swamiji introduced in his idea of service to humanity was to demonstrate in his own life how this ideal could be made practical. And the first thing he did was to establish the Ramakrishna Order with its twin organizations, the Ramakrishna Mutt and the Ramakrishna Mission, as sort of a central point for the dissemination of these ideas. Atmano mokshartam jagatitaya cha, for one's own liberation and for the uplift or the benefit of humankind. Now, Swamiji artfully shaped this message in a way that fully involves society and people from all walks of life. He did not exclude any segment of society or any person. And in doing so, I think we can say he was fulfilling a need for the modern age, which was a response to the time spirit. This being the age of humankind, the idea of worship of God and humanity fit in perfectly. Swami Vivekananda was deeply interested in anything to do with people. Wherever he found human excellence, in whatever field, he admired it. You know, other spiritual teachers were primarily concerned with the spiritual development of people. Swami Vivekananda was interested in all-round development. He considered the totality of life and experience as worthy of attention. And he wanted each individual to reach his or her full potential by developing and using natural-born talents and abilities, along with what they learned through education, for the benefit of others through unselfish work. He himself was a wonderful example of this. Now, Swamiji primarily, of course, was a spiritual teacher, but he was also a teacher of Dharma. And he was interested in the material well-being of people, as we know from his experience in India. You know, we're all in different stages of evolution, all of us. We're on different rungs of the ladder in our struggle to reach a higher form of existence. So we have different needs. None of us have the same needs. My need won't be your need's not her need or his need. We all have different needs. Now, Swami Vivekananda never denied those needs. He basically wanted to lift people up from where they were because he felt that a person should become the best possible person that they can be. So wherever he found a person, he wanted to lift him or her up to reach their fullest potential and move them on. That's one of the main differences between Swami Vivekananda and other spiritual teachers. Now, one of the reasons that Swamiji speaks so much about strength, if you read Swami Vivekananda's works, excuse me, his letters, etc., you can see there's a few themes that run through Swamiji's works. And one of those themes is strength. Another theme is fearlessness. Swamiji recognized that individuals needed strength and courage to manifest their own divinity. You know, we can't see outside of us what we don't have inside of us. So in order to see the divinity in others, we have to see it in ourselves first. This is a really important point, and one that Swamiji stressed, that we need this courage and this strength to practice our spiritual disciplines. They go hand in hand, side by side. It's not that we suddenly can start serving humanity and, you know, we're going to be, our spiritual life is going to be, you know, immediately uplifted. Yes, it takes time, but we also have to work on the inside. What we have inside, we see outside. This is a very important point, according to Swami Vivekananda. And furthermore, if we're strong, if we develop inner strength, we're actually in a better position to face all of the reactions that we have to face in life, all of the adverse reactions or influences. Things arise from inside of us, inside our own minds, our own conflicts, just within ourselves, and also in our contact with people, family members, work, whatever. So our lives are kind of a bundle of compromises and contradictions. Swamiji was very practical, and he knew that each one of us has to face these problems, and we need strength to do that. His concern was more with our practical problems in our life, more than just mere intellectuality or philosophy. So the ideal of service as worship, according to Swamiji, is life-oriented. That's the point. It's something that we can do as a practice in our everyday life. If there's anything that we can say that Swami Vivekananda was not, it would be theoretical. For this reason, he could relate to us by presenting the ideal in such a way that it is accessible to each one of us so that we can practice it each in his or her own way, according to our predilections, according to our temperaments. Swamiji gave these instructions. Now, sometimes it's said that Swamiji didn't really leave behind a systematic and well-developed philosophy of work. And in a way, that's true. But Swamiji felt that life itself is religion, and that living rightly can be a progressive self-revelation of our own higher nature. He didn't feel it was something outside of our life, something that we had to go outside of society to do. No, within our own circumstances, within our own families, within our own jobs, Swamiji felt and has given us a way to spiritualize it. It's a straightforward approach. It doesn't need a long, complicated philosophy. If we say that Brahman, or our higher spiritual nature, is the only reality, then not only in a transcendent reality or state beyond this world, but every activity in this world should be capable of revealing the truth. Now, this approach removes the distinction between secular and sacred. And of course, Swamiji's experience was everything is sacred. We know this from his works. We know this from Sister Nivedita's works. This was Swamiji's main thrust. Everything is sacred. There's nothing secular here. So based on this, he wanted each one of us to imbibe in our lives these universal spiritual truths to help us move forward. Now, we all have to find our own way to freedom, don't we? And we're all in different stages, and we're all doing different kinds of work here. Whether you're a scientist, or you're a lawyer, or you're a doctor, or you're a nurse, or you're a housewife, teacher, scientist, doesn't matter what you are or what you're doing. But somehow, we have to figure out, without changing our circumstances, without changing our work, we have to figure out how to spiritualize it by changing our attitude toward the work we're doing. And that's what Karma Yoga is all about, the change of attitude. When we study Swami Vivekananda's Karma Yoga, we find that they're based on this integral vision of the sacredness of everything. We can say it's kind of the applied science of how to do work, which forms the basis of the ideal of service as worship. You know, Karma Yoga is a technique, we can say, for the development of the mind. It's actually a mental discipline. So service done in the spirit of Karma Yoga is the spiritual discipline which can convey ordinary work. It can actually convert ordinary work into a means for spiritual advancement. When you do work for others, or when you serve others with this spirit, you actually are purifying your own heart. It's actually beneficial to the person performing the action. Swamiji says, as you work in this spirit, you slowly begin to feel the truth that the spiritual essence within yourself is actually pervading all beings. It's a very profound statement. So how do we go about converting work into worship? What's the practical means for doing this? You know, as in all spiritual practices, there are certain mental conditions that are necessary to accomplish this. And Sri Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita had such a high regard for Karma Yoga that in the 10th chapter of the Gita, he considered Karma Yoga to be Buddhi Yoga. So what do we mean by Buddhi Yoga? So put simply, it means we have to develop our power of discrimination. Now, we all use our power of discrimination in our everyday lives. But Buddhi is the higher faculty. It's a higher manifestation of this faculty of discrimination. This is the English word that's often associated with Buddhi. So in order to develop that, how to go about doing that? Well, we can put it very simply. You know, to have a keen sense of discrimination, we have to have a correct measure of things. And how do we have a correct measure of things in our lives or the world around us? We have to evaluate everything in terms of whether it's eternal, whether it's unchanging, imperishable, it's infinite, as opposed to something that's transitory, passing. It doesn't last until tomorrow. This is how the Gita describes it. So when a person exercises their discrimination, they always use this as the gold standard. Is this something that's absolutely eternal? It's imperishable, it doesn't change, it's undivided, it's infinite? Or is it something that changes? You know, life is fluid. And we often get stuck someplace in our life because we consider things as static. We think things will never change. But as we go through life, we get more experiences, we begin to realize more and more that life is extremely fluid. Nothing stays the same, not even for 2 minutes together if you look closely. So this is one of the primary things about discrimination. Learn to look at things in this way, no matter what it is, would actually relieve a great deal of mental tension that we have. The other thing is, a person needs to have a very strong moral sense. What to do and what not to do. How many times we make mistakes simply because we don't pause and take this into consideration? Is this something beneficial for myself, beneficial for someone else, or is it just some selfish interest? So these two things, I think, are very important in thinking about discrimination, as opposed to just the textbook definition of what discrimination is. Think of it in terms of your life and the decisions that you have to make. It's very important. So the effort here in the practice of discrimination is always to try to bring our ordinary mind, which in Vedanta describes the ordinary mind as vacillating, vibrating, not staying focused, constantly moving, shifting, weighing pros and cons, this and that. That's the ordinary mind. It's the buddhi that actually is the determinative faculty. It's the buddhi that says, no, I should do this, not that. I should take up this course of action, not that course of action. So we all strive in our practice to somehow bring our ordinary mind that vacillates constantly. You know how your mind vacillates, just watch it. We get used to living kind of on autopilot and kind of in an unconscious state. But when you actually try to meditate or you try to quiet the mind, then you know what the mind really is. So we try to bring it slowly, slowly through practice under the control of this higher faculty. Besides discrimination, another practice that's recommended for trying to convert work into worship is detachment. And detachment has kind of a bad name, in a sense, because it's often thought of as a negative practice, which is not true. Detachment is a positive practice. You know, it's trying to redirect our energy away from our limited self and expand it into the infinite. By simply separating ourselves to some extent from work, or even from people in the sense of our reactions to different individuals, before we know it, we get entangled in this huge web. If we're a little detached, this is an inner practice, not an outside practice, an inner practice. If we can learn to separate ourselves to some extent from our actions and from our interactions with others, we will learn how to react positively. We learn how to make purposeful decisions. Well, detachment is enormously helpful. Even in ordinary life, it's helpful because it helps us separate ourselves to some extent in our relationships with other people, in our work, etc., in our relationships with our boss or whoever. If we're slightly separated, we don't get entangled into this huge mess where we cannot extricate ourselves. So amount of detachment is very important. You know, we want to transform ourselves as we normally understand ourselves and try to experience ourselves in a different level of being. We all know, you know, day-to-day life, we know I'm so-and-so and I have this job and I'm like this and my personality's like that and I'm so tall and so on and so forth. That's just an ordinary way of looking at ourselves. As spiritual seekers, we're trying to view ourselves as we really are. And we're slowly trying to identify with the spiritual dimension of our being. This is one of the purposes and one of the points of Swamiji's introducing this practice. You know, it's a matter of returning our attention away from the small self, we can say, our limited self, and focusing on our true spiritual self. And we can say, well, what does that mean? It's just words. But the fact is, we have faith in what the rishis, what the sages, what the ancient and modern both, our spiritual masters who have experienced the spiritual dimension of their being, which is the same as the spiritual dimension of our being, they've actually experienced that. If one person can experience it, we can all experience it because it's our true nature. So this is what it means to say that we want to move away from our ordinary self to our spiritual self. That's the kind of the bottom line of what it means. And when we serve others, a kind of natural self-forgetfulness comes, does it not? I mean, think of a mother who has a sick child. Her whole mind goes to the child. She's not thinking, oh, I'd like to sit down and read a magazine, or she's not thinking like that. Just in an ordinary sense, her whole energy, her whole mind goes to helping that child. Or think of a doctor or a nurse with patients, and the patient's suffering, they're in pain. Their whole attention goes on how they can alleviate that pain and help the person. And in so many other areas of life, this is what it means to serve and to worship. It's just we need to change our attitude towards what we're doing. For example, take in India, you know, they're garland sellers, and they make these gorgeous, beautiful garlands for the deity. They're doing it to make money. They're not necessarily devotees. But a devotee or a worshiper, say, of Lord Vishnu or Lord Shiva, comes and purchases that garland, and they use it in their own personal puja as an act of devotion. There's a difference in the attitude there. This is what we mean by changing our attitude. The garland seller, he may be a great devotee, but he may not be. He may just be very artistic, and he can arrange the flowers beautifully. He makes a nice garland, and he sells that garland, and he makes money. Someone else uses that garland in the worship of God. So it's a difference of attitude. You know, through service, we learn to loosen the ego's grip. We're so invested, you know, our ego is very invested in whatever we do, whatever we think, whatever we say. The ego's number one. And, you know, there again, ego is kind of a word. But what does it mean? It means our own self-identification. We come into this world, we don't know where we came from, we're born in some family, we're given some name, we're educated, born in a particular religious tradition. We don't have any choice about that. We find ourselves in particular situations, and over time, we build up an identification with ourselves, and we say, you know, I'm Frank Smith, or I'm Mary Brown, or I'm so-and-so. That's just a relative, ephemeral identification. It's not our true identification. So Vedanta always makes this distinction between these two. So karma yoga is the method that helps us to extricate ourselves from this entanglement in action. It's the intelligent way to act. It's something like, you know, you pull an electrical cord out of the wall, And the potential for electricity is still there, but when you pull the cord out, then what happens? Okay, so then the clock stops, and your computer turns off, and your phone stops charging, etc. So in the same way, when we disconnect the ego from our action, we get the result. Unselfish work is work that's done without the thought of self. It's pretty simple. If we say we're selfless, it's self minus the self. This is selfless action. Does it mean we don't act? No, we act. But we don't have the contamination of selfishness or a personal gain or something to be gained by that. We try to disconnect ourselves from our work in that way. It's a mental attitude. So we are instructed, yes, we should throw ourselves into our work, wholeheartedly. But the Gita, Sri Krishna always says, we should not try to claim the results. Now that's a hard one, because we feel like even the Gita says, even a fool wouldn't do any work if they don't expect some result. But what is the result you're expecting? That's the point. If you're expecting something particular from the job that you're doing, according to the Gita, that's a bondage. We need to wish or expect a higher result. And in the Gita, this is called dexterity in action. In the Sanskrit is yoga karmasu kaushalam. It means being extremely dexterous in work. You know, there are different mental attitudes for this detachment in work. For spiritual seekers, we're talking about now. I mean, some seekers will work and they will say, I'm not the doer, it's nature that's working, so on. And that way they try to disconnect their ego. Some people think of it as, I'm offering everything to my chosen idea of God or goddess. It's the Lord within me that's working. And some people take a karma yoga attitude and say, it's just for the sake of the work that I'm doing. I have no interest in, you know, success or failure or gain or loss. But the point is, all of these are mental approaches, and they're stressing the same thing, just in different language and using different concepts, that's all. But the point is, we want to try to disconnect ourselves. You know, Swami Vivekananda said, the greatest benefactors of humanity have been those who were without thought of self. And we can think of quite a few of those. Think of Mahatma Gandhi. In our country, think of Abraham Lincoln, Martin Luther King. There are many examples that we can think of in different countries, Viktor Frankl, so many people who actually had the interest in other people, unselfish service, and no thought for themselves or their personal gain or loss. It's rare, but we can find many instances of it. So we can say our most effective work is when we can let go of our storyline and leave our self-interest behind. And just do it work for the work's sake. So we need to focus on the divine within ourselves and not on our egotistic self or what we're gaining from that. Now the third mental condition for converting work into worship, besides discrimination and detachment, we can call it as aspiration. And you know, aspiration is like the conscious goal behind all actions. So aspiration involves our motive for doing something. I aspire to be a doctor. I aspire to be a great scientist. So I have a motive for my action. And the motive is determined by my attitude. These things are all connected. So what actually makes karma, we can say, our work, yoga, is the spirit behind the work. That's what I'm trying to get at. It's the attitude with which something is done, which purifies the mind, not the act itself. So these three, we can call them mental conditions. This discrimination, trying to be detached, separating ourselves, and our aspiration, our motive, our attitude. These are all necessary to convert ordinary work, which we all have to do, into a worship for a means for our spiritual advancement. Now, there are also some subsidiary benefits to practicing karma yoga through service. Provides a creative outlet for channeling energy in socially useful ways. This is a very positive side of karma yoga. You know, in our private practice, we may even forget our spiritual ideal, we may forget the Lord and so on. But when we're serving someone else, we at least have the advantage, hopefully, that someone else has benefited. And another advantage here is that when we work, our shortcomings are drawn to our attention. Our ego is rubbed. You know, we can go through our whole life not recognizing or at least denying or whatever we want to do the sides of our nature that maybe aren't so pleasant or aren't so helpful for our growth. But a spiritual seeker is bold. And as I said, Swami Vivekananda said, strength and courage are needed. You have to be able to look at yourself for what you are. And none of us are perfect, or we wouldn't be here. So this is another advantage through work, is that we're pushed. People push us, push our buttons. So some of the sides of our nature that need, that are rough, so to say, they're smoothed and out through our contact with other people. This is all to our advantage. And we're talking about spiritual seekers here, not a worldly person. The other thing I think that we have to remember in our spiritual endeavors is that when we engage in some activity which doesn't have anything to do with our spiritual life, we become part-time spiritual seekers. And we want to be full-time spiritual seekers, so everything that we do, we want to connect it to our spiritual ideal. Otherwise, we may have a part-time job, but we don't want to be part-time spiritual seekers. So whatever we do, all of these attitudes that we take, it's for becoming a full-time spiritual seeker. Not easy, but it's something that we all have to do if we're sincere in trying to have our spiritual nature manifest. So, you know, in converting work to worship, I will just say that there are different phases. In fact, it's probably a subject for another talk entirely. But for a seeker, as they're progressing, there are different levels, let's put it that way. And when we first start, it's almost as if it's a dual attitude. We have work and we have worship. It's work and worship, two separate activities. And the person performing that feels, I am doing this. This is my action, this is my worship, and so on. And then initially, this is, for everyone, this is how it is, work and worship. Most of us fall into this category in whatever we do. We're identified with what we do. It takes a lot of spiritual practice to bring this dissociation, but this is how we start. You know, it's kind of like if a person wants to become a neurosurgeon and they really want to do that. Well, they can't just walk into a hospital and say, okay, I'm ready. No, it takes years and years of study and practice, etc. So we all know that even to gain something in this world, how hard we have to work to get it. But somehow when it comes to religion or spiritual life, it's like we feel like we shouldn't have to do anything. Unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. We have to do quite a bit because we're trying to transform our whole personality. But the gain is something that our spiritual teachers tell us that it is bliss without any sorrow. It is joy. It's something that 100% we want to go after because everything else here is going to die. It's going to perish. It's going to change. Look at the world today. It's not the same as it was 10 years ago, 20 years ago. It won't be the same 5 years from now. So if we hook ourselves onto these transitory things, we can see where we're going. When we try to feel the presence of God within every being, then work can become worship. And every person has to figure this out according to their own temperament. You know, actually the worship of God is serving the living God. Swami Vivekananda wanted all of us to practice this and to ultimately realize our true self. So we have to serve, we can say, with the as-if principle. We serve as if we're actually receiving the Lord himself, and however we conceive of the Lord, not necessarily as a person, maybe as a light, as consciousness, as joy. So when we're practicing as if, I'm disciplining my child as if I see the baby Krishna there and I take the proper action there. Or I'm a teacher and I try to perceive the divine there. This is an inward practice. Others on the outside, they don't know what your inner attitude is and your actions. But you will see that if you hold this attitude, those who you serve will respond in like kind. A change takes place within us when we change our mental attitude. And those around us feel that and respond in like manner. You know, Swami Vivekananda said, you may build a temple in which to worship God, and that may be good. But a better one, a much higher one, already exists, the human body. If you can't worship God, the manifested God, how can you worship the unmanifest? After all, everywhere, the same God. These are his forms before thee. Rejecting them, friend, where dost thou seek? So worship, then, is not just an action, it's an attitude. And as I said at the beginning, it is in this way that we are taking a different look at the meaning of the word worship. The actual feeling inside is the same. We have reverence. We develop reverence and respect, adoration, because we're worshiping not the individual, we're worshiping the Lord within that person. In the temple, of course, we worship these great saints, God-men, God-women, and we offer them whatever is beautiful. In the same way, we can do that with our fellow human beings. You know, what our attitude is depends upon our conception of humankind. How do we think of others? We are divine, everyone is divine, so it's the thought that God is within everyone that makes our work or makes our service worship. It's the thought that accompanies the service that's important. Otherwise, certain actions alone would be conducive to our spiritual growth and others would be a hindrance. Swami Vivekananda wanted to remove this outdated idea by substituting the broad ideal of considering service from both points of view, for my own liberation, for my own spiritual advancement, and for the benefit of others. Worship of God in whatever form he appears to us by giving him or her whatever is needed. If we're serving in a soup kitchen, we're worshiping God through giving him food. If we're Doctors Without Borders, we're worshiping individuals with medicine to help them, regardless of their race or their religious affiliation. So in all of these ways, this is how we do this. And service, by the way, includes all type of action. It's physical, it can be mental, educational, cultural, and of course, spiritual service. We can send good thoughts. We can pray for others. We can wish them well and treat them with respect. Even in our current world and situation today, we can send positive thoughts to end war, to end violence, to end so many negative things that are in our society. What can we do? We feel helpless sometimes. No, we're not helpless. Even sending positive thoughts and prayer has a tremendous effect. It's something we can all do for the benefit of humanity. So the type of service that we perform obviously depends on the need And one final thing we can ask, is it possible to engage in social work? We often hear this question, which at the same time can lead us to our personal freedom? Yes, we can. However, Swamiji's ideal should not be equated with mere philanthropic humanism or charity. You know, ideal service is not merely a social ideal, but it's a spiritual ideal. I mean, society is part of it, it's just not whole of it. It's not the whole of it. So we can call it, if you wish, spiritual humanism. In Swamiji's ideal of service, the center is the divine within. The divine within an individual, and the circumference is God within the whole of humanity. Whereas in social service, the center is actually a human being, and society is the circumference. That's the difference. So we can say, is Swamiji's ideal humanity-centered or God-centered? Well, it's both. You know, the world is in need of all kinds of service. And there's a heightened awareness today of the worldwide needs, and there are hundreds of service organizations that are trying to fulfill these needs. Selfless service, if it's done with the right spirit, can solve many problems. And at the same time, it can help the seeker spiritually. And the service that's rendered is of a higher quality, as I've already explained, so it actually benefits the recipient. But we are cautioned not to bring the ideal down. And this is important. Instead of reconciling ideal with life, we have to elevate life to the ideal. That is why we are constantly reminded to check our attitude. Don't think of a person just as a material being. Don't think of your children just as my children, as material beings. If it's just personal, centered service, person-centered service, it becomes materialistic. There always should be a spiritual ideal, should be the guiding force behind all our actions. So service is really, Swamiji's service is actually rooted in higher principles. And that's necessary if it's to have a permanent value. If it's just based on ephemeral worldly values, it becomes a dead end, and as we know, burnout is the result. So Swamiji wanted to elevate all social movements into the realm of the sadhana for this very reason. And as I said in the beginning, Swamiji was interested in all of man, all-round development. Swamiji was interested. If our actions are done with this attitude, eventually our work actually becomes a worship. You know, in our sojourn on earth, we have to work to make our life meaningful. We're all searching for our meaning for life here. And we know that our life cannot, I mean, the meaning of our life cannot be fulfilled in just a materialistic end. It's something further than that. So as part of our sadhana, we should do something for others. You know, Swamiji said, they alone who live for others. The rest are more dead than alive. You know, service obliterates the various boundaries that stand as hurdles in the expansion of consciousness. Swami Akandananda, one of Sri Ramakrishna's disciples, remarked that by serving, the heart is purified. By serving, the heart expands. And by serving, we see oneself in all. It is this practice of the presence of God in all that makes service to men and women spiritual and converts humanity-centered service into God-centered sadhana. That's how it's done. You know, Swamiji said, doing work is not religion. But work done rightly leads to liberation. So I'd like to conclude with a message that Swamiji gave for all of us. After so much austerity, Swamiji said, I have understood this as the real truth. God is present in every individual. There is no other God besides that. Who serves others serves God indeed. What I have told you today, inscribe in your heart. See that you do not forget it. Om Jo Shantir Antariksham Shanti Prithivi Shantir Apa Shantihi O Shadhaya Shantir Vanaspataya Shantir Vishwe Deva Shantir Brahma Shanti Sarvam Shanti Shantir Eva Shantihi Same Shantirehi Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi. Peace is in heaven, peace is in the sky, on the earth and in the waters. The herbs, the plants, and the trees are all full of peace. The gods are peaceful. Everything in the universe is pervaded by peace. May this eternal, universal peace enter our soul and being. Om, peace, peace. Peace be unto us all and to all beings everywhere.